Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, shock as the entire PIC board is replaced. The acquisition of a local liquor store brand paves the way for big African expansion. Retail shows growth in 2025, but tech sales continue to lag. And the future of work, it's not hybrid, it's intentional. It's Friday, the 19th of September. Now, South Africa waking up this week to news that the entire board of the Public Investment Corporation, steward of nearly 3.9 trillion rand in public service pensions, had been replaced. The announcement was tucked away in a single line of cabinet statement with no real explanation and no public scrutiny. Only one of the 10 new directors has any asset management experience. The stakes could not be higher. The PIC is the state's asset manager, and how its government affects every teacher, every nurse, every police officer whose retirement depends on it. With me now is Musi Maimane, who's leader of the party Build One South Africa and also chair of Parliament's Standing Committee on Appropriations. Musi, welcome. Why do you believe this board reshuffle was handled in such a low-key and almost opaque manner?
Good afternoon and good afternoon to fellow South Africans. Jeremy, this is the whole point behind how our governance infrastructure is often put together. Ministries establish boards. Those boards, whether they're through agencies, some of them MDDA in various places, become the preserve almost exclusively of the minister in charge. In this particular instance, it's the PIC, of which the Deputy Minister of Finance often chairs, is the chair of that particular board. And in the manner that they've handled it, really for me, raises the concern that as we saw with the state capture era, where effectively you pick a board that is able to do your own bidding, you can create assets, you can create a way in which government can gain access to finances. This could not be something that we simply as South Africans must allow. And my deeper concern is that as I've raised it and I've written formally to the Minister of Finance to say this matter cannot be handled in this manner, for if it continues in this manner, the assets, 3.9 trillion rands of South Africans' pensions, could really be in jeopardy if you hand them over to a management team that can't sustain it.
Can you amplify that for me a little? What specific risks do you see in appointing a board with little or no asset management experience?
Firstly, it's a choice in the choice in investments is the most immediate risk, right? Because in obvious sense, the applications that come through to the PIC for funding on various infrastructure projects, if they are poorly chosen, you could end up with an incident with the chicken farm that the previous board had invested in, where you end up with investments that have got no skills, no capacity, and end up failing. Secondly, you could end up in a space where the board can make decisions that are at the behest of the minister. And sometimes one of my key concerns is that often in a South Africa's fiscus, where it's running tight on money, it is able to attract that money back into the fiscus by getting money through to the PIC. And this is a deep concern for me, that money could effectively be sent back to Treasury. And I would think that is a dangerous move for South Africa's pensions. So ultimately, those two big risks for me are massive red flags. And that's why I continue to call for better scrutiny on how the PIC is managed and how this board is appointed.
Just in terms of the decision itself, if there was no clear misconduct by the previous board, have you wrapped your head around what might justify such a sweeping dismissal?
Not at all. And ultimately, boards are not appointed for permanent feature in any institution. And so naturally, what happens is that smart and smart governments tend to create a place where not all the terms of all the board members expire at the same time. This way, you can achieve renewal, which is often important in a board, but also you can achieve a sense of which there's continuity because experience is carried through. In this particular manner, none of that has been undertaken, and certainly the strong allegation coming from some of the board members has been that they were put through some fairly arbitrary psychometric examinations of some kind by the Minister of Finance, and they didn't get any response to that. So you've got a double challenge here, in that the first instance is that none of the board members can tell you why, even though they had capacity to can carry on functioning, why they were arbitrarily dismissed. But furthermore, how you simply wipe out the slate of the PIC board and introduce a new one. There are no reasons forthcoming. And I think the Minister of Finance owes it to the people of South Africa, given that this is the PIC. Were it another board, perhaps maybe the issue would be less so. But in this particular one, we're dealing with people's livelihoods and future savings, and therefore, and the country's fiscal stability. And therefore, I think better scrutiny is required in this regard.
So what do you say to the millions of public servants then whose pensions are effectively on the line, if I'm hearing you correctly?
Correct. I'm saying to them we must demand a thorough explanation as to what necessitated the change, what is the mandate of the current board, what are the other safeguards that can ensure that this board doesn't just simply do what, as they call it, the shareholder, which is Treasury or the Minister of Finance, can do. And ultimately, how do we, in managing the fact that this was a board that came in at a very difficult time in South Africa, South Africa was really rehabilitating itself from state capture, took the PRC's asset base from 2 trillion to over 3 trillion. How come, what kind of returns must they expect? Because at the end of the day, each one of us, regardless of who we are, put money today for future savings, and we want those savings to grow if they're going to be sustainable. So any civil servant needs to be able to have that kind of question put on the table.
I don't want to scaremonger here, but is there a precedent maybe that this sets for other state-owned entities like Eskom and Transnet, for instance?
Absolutely. And the broader challenge is that particularly agency boards of any kind. I mean, I look at the board of Eskom. I look at the current fights that we've been having in the CETA boards, the current war that is taking place between the Minister of Tourism and the Board of Tourism. All of these boards, the even more worrying thing is that none of them effectively come to Parliament. Only the ministers do. And then by the time the scrutiny then has to be advanced to the boards, it's almost so after the fact that enough damage could be done. So the precedent is in place. And I certainly think that it is an unhealthy governance practice if we're going to continue in this manner as South Africans.
Have you heard from the finance minister?
I await their response. The set of questions that put them were quite requiring of at least some thorough responses, and we certainly want to take this matter further. And if it requires legislative change, it needs to be able to do that. But I certainly think that it is an unhealthy practice, and we need to get better governance around these boards.
Thank you very much indeed. Musi Maimane, leader of Build One South Africa, also chair of Parliament's Standing Committee on Appropriations.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Nielsen IQ South Africa's State of the Retail Nation for the first half of 2025 report paints a mixed picture, I think. FMCG sales are up more than 7% in both value and volume, with traditional trade surging and snacks, liquor and tobacco all recording double-digit growth. But here's the rub. Tech and durables remain under pressure, dragged down by weak smartphone sales, and consumers continuing to spend cautiously, I guess, in the face of unemployment and ongoing high food prices. So what does this data really tell us about the health of the South African consumer? Joining me now is Lene Klopper, consumer panel services lead at NIQ South Africa. Lene, a very warm welcome. So as I've just mentioned, FMCG sales are growing strongly, but is this real growth or just higher prices, do you think, maybe driving bigger numbers?
Thanks, Jeremy. That's a very good question. So we're seeing value growth of just over 7%, But interestingly enough, for the first time in a while, we're seeing that the unit growth is also above 7%. So this is absolute growth. Consumers are purchasing more units. We do see a mixed bag, as you said earlier. So this isn't the case across all brands. But when we're having a look at the different categories, specifically the ones that you mentioned, snacking and tobacco, we really are seeing very good unit growth coming through. Not all driven by promotions, not all driven by inflation, but due to consumers actually spending a little bit more and buying a little bit more.
That's such an interesting marker because tobacco, as you say, and also liquor among the fastest growing categories. It says something, doesn't it, about our priorities in tough times?
Yes, for sure. I mean, those are two categories that we always see consumers intending spending on less, but we see the good growth coming through that.
Now, private label growth, I also read in your report, has stalled. In the past, this has been something of a winner in this survey. Do you think, Lene, consumers are losing faith maybe in supermarket house brands, or is there more to it?
So private label used to have a stigma around it, and we see that that stigma has faded. Consumers are interested in purchasing where they get best value for money, and lately there are a lot of really good private labels on the shelves that deliver that value for money that the consumers are seeking. We have seen it slow down. In the first half of this year, the growth was about 7.5% versus last year, it was almost 9%. And that has resulted in private label losing share within the first 6 months of this year compared to last year. But this isn't only attributable towards the performance of private label. It is because of how independent brands have really try to compete within private label on shelf. So our stronger brands and our independent brands have successfully defended their market share within the first half of this year through price promotions. Just an interesting fact, South Africa, of all the countries that Nielsen IQ measures globally, is one of the most price sensitive countries in both regular and promoted price. So driving those promotions really gets good uplift for our independent brands. And there has been aggressive marketing and a lot of innovations within these brands that has helped them rebound against private label brands.
On a wider canvas, your report also says that traditional trade is booming while modern trade is slowing. Explain that to me, and what does it say about who consumers trust the most right now?
Yes, so modern trade is about 3/4 of the spend within South African FMCG, and traditional trade is about 1/4. So it is a significant chunk of the market. And we've seen that modern trade has grown by about 5%, while traditional trade has grown by almost 15%. When we have a look at our home panel data, we also see that there is some very slight shifts out of bigger retailers where consumers are starting to purchase from traditional trade. That is very much attributable to the fact that people are very much on the go. There's a lot of activity with people going to work, going to different places, and traditional trade has that very good convenience aspect that consumers are looking for. Just another interesting thing, we have seen that retailer repertoire within households have shrunk quite significantly. A few years ago, just before COVID, consumers or households were shopping around 9 different retailers, but now the average is about 4 retailers, dropping 5 retailers out of their repertoire on average. And that is due to the fact that households really want to make their loyalty cards work for them. So where there is very good opportunity for households to get a little bit of pressure off their pocket by good loyalty programs, they will stick to the retailer. But the convenience aspect of traditional trade is what consumers are really interested in at the moment.
Overall, consumers, and we understand this against a very tight economic trading environment, are trading down. As you've referenced, they are chasing promotions. Loyalty cards become a whole lot more important. But going forward, how sustainable is this growth picture, do you think?
Look, it is very mixed. So we see that consumers remain strategic and frugal in their spending. But we also see that we have some consumers making small discretionary purchases within FMCG. One really key thing that brands need to focus on is reaching into the channels that are doing well, such as traditional trade, focusing on those targeted promotion, And we have different consumers. We've got our value-conscious consumers and we have our premium consumers. So brands really need to ensure that they have an offering for each of those consumers going forward. And then when we're having a look at retailers, obviously the aim is to maximize our basket sizes, but targeting those promotions and those retail programs that they have is really key for success.
You also say in the report that smartphone sales have slumped sharply. Now, I'm wondering if it's an indication that maybe tech innovation has hit a ceiling. Probably not. Or that wallets are just too thin these days.
Yes, I mean, we have some premium price point smartphones out there that is just very unaffordable for majority of South Africans. And there's a much slower replacement rate. So earlier this year, we also saw that there was a slowdown, and this has continued into the first half of this year. The trading down into cheaper brands is also really prevalent within the smartphone market because they offer the same features that your very expensive smartphone brands offer. We also see that these AI apps that are on the latest phones are not really as appealing to consumers yet, and that's not really helping that upsell within smartphones. We also know that software updates are supported for a longer time, so the replacement rate isn't under pressure within software, within the new innovative apps that are coming out. And there's just not enough pressure on consumers to upgrade their phones right now because of the innovations happening within the space.
And that is the state of the retail nation for the first half of 2025. I've been in conversation with Lane Klopper, Consumer Panel Services Lead at NIQ South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, I read that South Africa's liquor sector is about to take on a new shape. Fine Wine Fellow has announced plans to acquire Norman Goodfellow's, giving one of the country's most established premium wine and spirits distributors a springboard into the fast-growing African market, with competition intensifying at home and consumer tastes, I think, shifting towards more premium experiences. The deal could redefine how South Africa's beverage industry positions itself across the continent. It's an interesting story. Joining me now is Jason McAvoy, who's Chief Executive Officer of Norman Goodfellow's. Jason, a very warm welcome. You've built a trusted brand over nearly five decades, as I understand it. How do you expand then aggressively across Africa without diluting that heritage?
We're very proud of our 49 years, and I've got to make sure that we keep our values and our heritage intact. And I wouldn't say that it's aggressively grow throughout Africa. Fine Wine Fellows has interest in eight African countries, and soon to be 10. And the Africa is an amazing opportunity, but many a company have not succeeded in Africa. And our advantage is we've got partners with the infrastructure on the ground and local knowledge on how to operate in a country.
There's no doubt the African premium drinks market is growing fast, but as you've said, others have gone in, other organizations, and have been burnt in the past. Logistics, I would imagine, regulation do remain hurdles. Which of those difficulties or challenges, Jason, would worry you the most?
The truth is that with partners that have been in Africa for 20 years, we can now do this without worrying. We're not going into green fields. We're not trying to figure things out ourselves. We have people experienced on the ground.
South Africa's economy is also, in many respects, flatlining. Is this, what kind of play is this as far as Norman Goodfellow's is concerned? Are you relying more now on African expansion to deliver growth as opposed perhaps to the home market? How do you achieve that balance?
So we would look to increase our retail footprint in South Africa at the same time as going into Africa. Our economy is flatlining, but to be able to grow into Africa gives us ability to significantly scale our business. And the African drinks market is looking to overtake the American drinks market by 2030 based on a 5% compounded growth rate.
It's interesting, though, because while you're expanding, the deal also comes, I think, at a time of rising anti-alcohol sentiment, certainly in some policy circles. Do you think it's going to be difficult to manage reputational risk on the one hand while chasing the growth that you're obviously doing?
Well, I think, in the first world markets, there's a significant shift away from alcohol into sort of health and as well as alternatives like CBD or things like that. I mean, in our markets, we haven't seen that trend. And in Africa, that trend is not prevalent. So I think in the sort of more third world or second world, it's less prevalent.
So you're entering a highly competitive, but as we've referenced already, fragmented markets. What's giving you the confidence then that you can overcome the barriers to entry and also defend market share?
Well, within South Africa, so we've got our retail business, which our brand is best known for. But the largest part of our business is our redistribution business, where we actually supply both food and beverage into the hospitality sector. And on the redistribution side, we've got significant competition. On the retail side, we actually see ourselves as a niche player. We're very much a destination store. So our customers will shop at our competitors on a weekly basis for convenience, because within a 5 kilometer radius or less, you'll find a Tops, a Checkers, a Pick and Pay Liquor, whatever it may be. But our customers will come to us when they're looking for something special, when they need advice, or they're looking for the depth of range. We carry over 10,000 products across our business.
And it's also interesting, Jason, beyond that as well, because it's also these days about experiential shopping. How are you handling that particular side of the equation?
So that's exactly what we're about, destination due to the experience. So the biggest part is with staff being highly trained and knowledgeable, being able to give advice, to customers. Often there's tastings in our stores, so you can get liquid to lips and taste what you're going to buy before you buy it. That's a corner of our retail business.
And I without giving strategic secrets away here, I would imagine that there's no doubt that consolidation is accelerating in food and beverages the world over. Are you starting now to position your brand to lead regional integration, or is there a plan at some point, or even a risk maybe, of being absorbed into something bigger down the line? Or am I calling that a little bit too early, do you think?
I don't think so, because we do what we do because we are entrepreneurial and we have the ability to make quick decisions and are agile. And being absorbed into something bigger generally means it goes into a sort of big corporate structure, which is not agile. And that in a redistribution industry and in servicing restaurants, hotels, pubs and clubs, it doesn't work. We've seen it with acquisitions in the past that have failed.
Fine Wine Fellow, as I understand it, and you can educate me a little bit if you want to, I think operates in a number of African markets. I'm wondering if there are lessons from big markets like maybe Nigeria or Senegal or even the Ivory Coast that's going to roll out guide your rollout strategy.
So the rollout strategy would be to take our retail and e-com brand there, and much like in our market, to be destination-based range and premium product. And probably starting with Nigeria or something like that first.
And just, Jason, finally then, 5 years hence, what's success going to look like, do you think?
It would be to have normal good fellows in 10 African countries, to have created jobs both in South Africa and abroad as a result of growing our business.
Thank you very much indeed. Jason McAvoy, Chief Executive Officer of Norman Goodfellows.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Let's move on to this now. And for years, we've been told the future of work is hybrid, part office, part remote. But my next guest argues that that's missing the point. Gary Bateman is the founder of consulting firm The Mechanics of Business and says it's not about where people work, but why, when, and how. In short, the real future of work, he says, isn't hybrid, but it's intentional. So, Gary, a very warm welcome. And let's start with this. You say hybrid isn't just a structure. I'm interested to know what you mean by that.
Well, Jeremy, hybrid is really from where people work. And it's something that's happened by default. When COVID hit us, and this is something I personally experienced, when COVID hit us, we all just started working from home by default. There was no thought put to it, no processes put in place to address issues from working from home or making life simpler. And today, I think so many companies still consider a hybrid work environment, letting their team work from home. And really, that's not the point. What we need to consider for hybrid is putting in place a deliberate, created virtual office structure. So that brings to the hybrid environment similar structures to what we would have for in-office people.
So what type of structure are we talking about?
So starting from the very first, one needs to have a very, very solid hybrid work policy that addresses all aspects of who is going to work from home, when are they going to work from home, and what is the work environment expected in the hybrid work environment, so that all the tools are available for them to be able to operate at the same level as those that are permanently in office would be able to operate at.
And those tools, Gary, equal intentionality. Why do you believe that matters more than the ongoing office versus remote debate?
Because everything to date really just has happened by default. There's never been any thought put behind how do we address the issues that people that work hybridly are going to face. And as much as there are significant benefits from working from hybrid, if one doesn't consider the issues such as isolation, a potential communication gap, the blurring of boundaries between work environment and home environment, and the mental stress that puts on the employees, if we don't consider that, then all the benefits of a hybrid work environment are quickly lost.
Are companies not starting to come to terms with that, though, and putting those structures in place, or is that just a fallacy, do you think?
I think certain companies are, but the majority, I believe, are still working by default and consider flexibility. We let our people work from home a couple of days a week, and that is really what hybrid is. And they're missing the point of to really engage employees and to keep them committed and give them the proper flexibility. There needs to be a lot more thought and preparation behind setting up this virtual office environment. And I think a lot of companies are still acting by default rather than by intent.
Fundamentally, though, it's all about performance, isn't it? And this intentionality, does it in any way change the method of measurement of productivity and performance?
It sure does. A lot of managers today still sit with the mindset of being present in the office is what's key. And what I'm trying to bring over is that we need to drive performance rather than attendance. Meetings and connections between team members need to be by design and not default. Yes, there's still significant value of certain meetings and interactions taking place face-to-face, but really it needs to be by design rather than by default. And management of people needs to be more, we set the goals, we set the KPIs, and we need to build that trust with the team that they're going to deliver on that and measure the team to the deliverables that they are bringing, rather than the amount of time they're spending online or spending in the office.
And I think that's a critical point. And it does require, I imagine, a certain degree of courage, because many leaders, as you rightly point out, still default to visibility and hours as proxies for performance. How then do you break that mindset, Gary?
It's a very difficult mindset to break. But I believe that, for example, the kind of workshops we as a consulting firm bring to corporates, we actually try and impart the necessary skills and management capabilities on the team to start building trust with the employees. These tools that can be put in place to develop the trust between management and the hybrid team. And with that building of trust, that requirement for visibility, that requirement for constant contact does start getting broken. And it becomes more about the deliverables and the outcomes of the team rather than by visibility or by being able to manage how long they are logged in online, etc.
And what type of tools would you be referring to?
There's a range of tools that work, that focus on culture and looking at shared values and purpose, tools that develop effective leadership, tools that manage the communication between the teams, and building rhythm and cadence in meetings. So, you know, things we recommend things such as a weekly check-in with the team, maybe a monthly team meeting, a quarterly offsite get-together. So there is that constant interaction that is by design, and that starts building the trust between the teams.
And it's so important, but often very difficult, because I'm sure you'll agree with me that culture within any organization often feels intangible and difficult to deliberately design something which inculcates belonging, recognition, and inclusion into that corporate system.
It does. And that's why we recommend that building of culture becomes intentional and gets embedded in every operating system within the company. Unfortunately, too many organizations still believe culture is something that can happen by chance, but we believe it's something that they need to be actively driven. And the aspects of culture that can be actively driven, you think such as your diversity, inclusion, your learning and development, empowering your team members, reward and recognition, regular communication plans and activities to drive those aspects. Culture can, you can actually take hold of those aspects of culture and you can actually drive it. So you don't leave it to chance. You actually drive, intentionally you drive those aspects of culture.
And just finally then, what are the risks to organizations if they cling to outdated ways of working?
So what we've seen with many clients is that by having a solid hybrid work environment and this well-structured virtual office, it gives significant strategic advantages. It gives a competitive advantage. So those companies that are doing this, they can leverage those strategic advantages, they can leverage those competitive advantages, and that pushes them to the forefront of the market that space that they are in. Those companies that are not adopting that, their risk is that they can get left behind and will lose that competitive advantage.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Gary Bateman, founder of the consulting firm The Mechanics of Business. And that is where we're going to leave it for this Friday. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.